You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Ben Steiner, Peter Galindo, and Alexander Gonge-Ruzic.
Welcome back inside the Northern Football Podcast. Ben Steiner alongside Peter Galindo and Alex Gonge-Ruzic. It's episode 96, post-game edition, after Canada lost 2-1 to Brazil in the women's national team action, and a 2-1 win thanks to Lucas Cavallini, of all people, against Japan ahead of World Cup Qatar. Remember to leave a review and a rating on Apple and Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Peter, Alex, how are you doing? It's been a big couple days in Canadian soccer.
Yes, it has. And I can already tell that Alex is a little peeved by the fact that you said, why of all people, when it comes to Lucas Cavallini, because he is our misunderstood Latino mans. So he probably will step to his defense shortly here.
Lucas Cavallini, he has a different specter of genius sometimes on the soccer field that isn't always understood. What some might do with long spraying passes and, you know, delicate shots he does with powerful bullets that escape from his left foot, but also Panenkas and yellow cards, and the fact that he won a game over Japan in the 94th minute with a Panenka. Like, come on, that's genius. But anyways,
it was a little too close to Ali Adnan for me. If any white cast fans remember, that is true. And barely. Zlatan wasn't on the pitch as well.
All I'm saying, Cavallini is so misunderstood. He's the first player I've ever seen to get hate for scoring a 94th minute Panenka penalty winner.
It's because it nearly didn't go in. Anyways, we're on. Canada, of course, gets the win this morning. A bit of a statement win as well. Stephen Vitoria equalized after Yuki Soma had opened the scoring in the 8th minute. It wasn't exactly a fantastic start for the Canadian team, maybe caught out a little bit on that first goal from Soma. I mean, if we just start early in the match, Canada took a little bit of time to sort of settle in to the rhythm of the game, and Japan kind of controlled the game, but it was also played at a pace that I don't think Canada has seen in a long time.
No, and they did actually go toe-to-toe with Japan too, which is impressive, even after all the subs were made and both teams were kind of trading blows. And it kind of makes you, I think, confident from a Canadian point of view that, and we're going to get into all of this, but that all of the following were able to be successfully ticked off. Number one, the transition defense was stellar for the most part against a team that you would have thought was going to cause them problems, much like Uruguay did, but that didn't happen. And then second, Herdman went for the jugular because he threw on Ismail Kone for Samuel Piet at halftime. He made all those attack-minded substitutions, and you can say that they've all paid off, right? Because Richie Larea draws the penalty. Lucas Cavallini barely scores the penalty. Jonathan Osorio looked good. Mark Anthony Kay looked good. There's really no qualms you can have outside of the early goal they conceded, but we talked about their resilience in the last episode. They certainly showed resilience to fight their way back against, sure, a not quite full strength Japan team. But regardless, they play the same way. They're going to play with the same intensity, the same pace of play. And they coped with that well. And they got a win, which I'm sure is going to boost confidence leading into the World Cup.
Yeah, ultimately, they went up against a good Japan side, albeit one missing a few starters, but also so is Canada. I mean, that's another result for Canada without Alphonso Davies and Stefan Oustakio, and credit has to be given for how they stepped up. And yeah, they conceded an early goal, but they responded, they got a goal, and then from there was a good 20 or 30 minutes where Canada was also controlling the tempo, which is nice to see, because as we mentioned at the time, it's one thing to control the tempo when you're trailing against Uruguay and they have no interest in, you know, trying to open themselves up and be vulnerable to Canada's speed, whereas Japan was, you know, this is a 1-1 game for, you know, the last 70 minutes. And there were good chunks of it where Canada was also controlling the initiative, which you like to see. I think, you know, ultimately, as Canada's shown now across, you know, against top teams, they will generate chances. If all goes well, they will finish them. And then on the positive side, you saw, you know, way better just midfield performance, at least defensively. They did a few tweaks tactically, which included Tiba Hutchinson playing a little deeper to mitigate that, and it ended up working. Are a few concerns maybe, you know, in terms of, okay, you're going to have to start winning a few more second balls. I think, interestingly enough, that was of all areas where Japan maybe got them, as well as, again, just being clean when you play out of the back, be it which also leads to the second balls. There are a few times where Canada played out, they didn't win second balls, and that's where Japan got their chances and got their goal. But for the most part, those are details again that Canada will clean up, and it's good to see that Canada's cleaning up the mistakes that really hampered them in those details. I'd feel a little more confident about them winning second balls when they're rocking a Stefan Oustakiou, Atiba Hutchinson double pivot, for example. I feel, you know, playing out of the back is only going to get better as some of these guys get match fitness. So I think they're on the right track in that regard. So it's positive to see at least they're heading into this Belgium game with a positive result, a positive mindset. And, you know, I think that's what you need given the spectre of opponent they're up against.
When I think another positive turn as well was the MLS players looked like comfortable in this game. They looked like they belonged. Whereas against Bahrain, sure, the conditions were a lot worse. That pitch looked like it belonged in CONCACAF, but they weren't so confident. And I think of a player like Marc-Anthony Kay, who was giving the ball away, looked like he had lapses in concentration throughout that Bahrain game. But today against Japan, 40 touches in half an hour, completed 31 of 35 passes, long balls, 2 of 3. He was good today. He won both of his ground duels, made a tackle as well, and an interception. So he looked confident, and he looks like he got that confidence from the Bahrain game just to sort of iron out a few of those wrinkles. And that's what that game was for.
Yeah. Well, yeah, all those MLS guys who struggled in that game ended up having pretty solid performances, or at the very least showed improvement from, and I know some of these guys got criticism, but from Kamal Miller all the way out to Lucas Cavallini. Although I think Cavallini did do okay in that Bahrain game, to be fair to him. But overall, every phase of play was remarkably better compared to the Uruguay game. Alex mentioned it there, Atiba Hutchinson, him coming back in, transformed their ability to play out of the back under pressure so significantly. And that in turn allowed Alistair Johnson to get forward, replicate his CF Montreal role, and then him and Buchanan were getting involved down that right flank, and it was lovely to see some of those outlet passes from Johnston. I slid out of my chair a couple times on a few of those passes. And overall, I think they managed the pressure well. Now, there were times where Alex did point out that when they went long, they lost the second balls, and you can't afford to do that at the World Cup. That's for sure. And that's something they're going to have to figure out, because that's really the one caveat. If you want to bypass the press by going vertically or going more direct, you have to win the second balls and be first to it. That is probably one area that they have to fix in that regard, but it was much, much better compared to Uruguay, where, surprise, surprise, Steven Vitoria wasn't the primary orchestrator back there. It was someone who was clearly much more confident in Atiba Hutchinson, and he looked very good, and I am more than confident that he will be fine against Belgium when he starts, not if he starts. So all in all, very good in that aspect of the game.
I mean, just last point to hop in before we move on. Just, I don't know how many questions we got on the midfield transitions and playing out the back, but the Atiba Hutchinson thing one was huge, because I think if you look at the Uruguay game, how they played out in that 3-4-2-1, what we saw was Stefan Oustakiou and Samuel Piette occupy more of a traditional double pivot. And just what happened is they both would naturally push forward. It's kind of the roles they play for their clubs. You know, where Piet's kind of turned into more of an aggressive eight, ditto with Stefan Oustakiou, they'd push up the field, a turnover would happen, and then that's where Canada would get burned, was when you have your two midfielders flying up and all of a sudden it's four Uruguay players running against Canada's back three, because the wingbacks obviously also pushed up. But what was nice is that by Atiba Hutchinson, the role that he's played, and I like it too, because it's going to be good, especially as he gets his fitness. Yeah, we know Atiba Hutchinson can play as an eight, but Stefan Oustakiou is playing as an eight now, so he doesn't need to. And to save his fitness and how good of it he is of a distributor, it was great to see him tuck in with the center backs, because what I noticed happening was, like you mentioned, Peter, they helped him play out of the back. The Alistair Johnson one is a huge one. And it was great just because when they did lose the ball, you know Alistair Johnson and Sam Adekugbe are going to track back.
Yep.
And by having Johnston push forward, you know that's not going to be an issue. Plus, what that allows is Hutchinson was always there. He was able to step up into a position of strength in midfield and you know, buy time for a guy like Samuel Piette to track back. And then when Stefan Oustakiou was in that role, I imagine he'll do the same. Because against Uruguay, what hurt was the double pivot would be caught up and both guys were sprinting back. And then they would just be chasing a shadow and they're trying to grab something, trying to stop. And it's hard to stop when an attacker has an attacking position on you. He has his, you know, he's between you and the goal. Whereas now with Hutchinson playing in that center back role, or not center back role, but center back role in possession, so to speak, in that back three. It was nice because in transition, he was able to step up into midfield to stop attacks instead of having to run back. And I thought that also cleaned up that area a lot. And I think that's going to be huge because if you're playing a Belgium and say it's Hutchinson and Eustachio and they're running back against a guy like De Bruyne, no chance. But at least with a guy like Kevin De Bruyne, you know that Thibaut Hutchinson, if he's going to be stepping out to occupy him and at least allow Canada to track back in those moments where they do turn over the ball, I think it made a big difference in terms of just limiting the dangerous areas Japan got into.
And I think they maintained that as well when Hutchinson left that midfield pivot and was replaced by Kea, and then Richie Larea comes in to replace Adekubi and, of course, draws the penalty later in the game. So they were able to maintain that style and the way they were playing, shifting from the three at the back to the five at the back throughout all the personnel that they used today. And so that shows that Canada not only can do things without Davies and Eustachio, of course, against a Japan team that was not exactly the top choice lineup, but they have the ability to continue playing their style throughout whatever personnel is available. With that in mind, it's time for Canada Against the Odds, brought to you by Sports Interaction. Want to bet? You can do it all at Sports Interaction, Canada's sportsbook. Every single World Cup game right at your fingertips. Bet pregame, live in play, or one of our many Canada-specific prop bets. Made for Canadians, by Canadians, Sports Interaction makes it easy to deposit, play, and cash out. Join now and see all sports betting has to offer at bit.ly/NFPOdd. That's bit.ly/NFPOdd. 19 plus, please play responsibly.
Yeah, so we just had the conversation about Canada's improvements in defensive transition and just the overall organization off the ball. I also wrote about this for Sportsnet if anybody wants to check that out. So the first thing that kind of came to mind when I was looking at some of the prop bets was there's actually kind of an intriguing one here. So Canada conceded 5 goals in the 1986 World Cup. There is now a prop bet comparing this 2022 team to that 1986 team, and they're asking how many will the 2022 team concede. So less than 5 goals gets you 81 to 50 odds, somewhere kind of around 2-1. 5 goals conceded exactly is 9-4. And then more than 5 goals, 137 to 100 or just above evens. So considering how disciplined Canada was defensively in this game, albeit against a team that was slightly rotated, but nonetheless would have given them problems probably a couple of months ago, and the weird nature of that goal, because as Alex kind of pointed out, that was the first of such kind they have conceded in about a year. So what are the odds of them having that being conceded again? Probably not that high. So if they can replicate that performance, I don't hate their chances of conceding less than 5 goals in 3 games at all. Their expected goals per 90 allowed over the last 12 months is 0.82. And that includes a penalty for Bahrain. So you take that out and it's probably a little lower than that. So from open play, Canada's always been very good defensively. If they can just be alert in the air, I have all the confidence in the world they can concede less than 5 goals in their 3 group games.
Yeah, I think you break it down well. And again, it's just, yeah, that and those transition moments, just try not to get feasted on by, you know, Kevin De Bruyne, Luka Modric, and Hakim Ziyech, who scored a beautiful goal today, by the way.
He did.
40-yard screamer against Georgia. So another player to add to midfield threats you might want to watch out in transition. I think if Canada can limit those moments, I think, you know, defensively, it's again, wild to say. I mean, yes, you look at some of the moments, but if Canada keeps their team defensive structure, they've been so solid. If anything, it feels like it's going to come down to, okay, can they be a bit, you know, a bit more clinical in the final third, which is, you know, funny to say. You'd think, you know, maybe a year ago it'd be the opposite, but Canada, it's just, okay, can they be clinical? But I think defensively, all the games are going to be quite tight. If there's any blowouts, you know that things are going to have gone catastrophically wrong. There's going to be some, you know, horrendous errors. And I think the fact that even they struggled horrifically out of the first 30 minutes against a team as good as Uruguay. And yes, it's only 2-0. I mean, 2-0 is a bad scoreline, but the fact that it was only 2-0, that, hey, maybe if, you know, Milan Borjan had positioned himself a bit differently in the wall, maybe it's only 1-0 and it's a whole different story in that game. So yeah, fine margins.
And we'll look at all of that, including every matchup, a little bit closer in our World Cup preview episode, that coming up in just a few days, because Canada's World Cup opener in just over a week now against Belgium. From Oz Sweeney at Oz Sweeney 4. Can we get Herdman on record saying no one is ever allowed to Panenka again? I'll just leave it to some of my favorite quotes from former Whitecaps FC head coach Carl Robinson. It comes down to fine lines. If you can do the Panenka,
wow,
go for it.
Wow. How dare you? How dare you, Ben?
I feel sick to my stomach.
Look, if that's Thibaut Courtois in goal, that gets saved. I am utterly convinced that gets saved because he has the length. He probably could have read Cavallini like a book. You could see that when he was slowing down his run-up. You're like, okay, he's going to probably try to chip this in some way. And sure enough, that's exactly what he did and very nearly got saved. That was ballsy. I will admit that I wouldn't have done it. But as John Herdman said after the game, that all... also does personify a new Canada, that you have the confidence to be able to pull that off, albeit in a friendly, but against a marquee team that is going to the World Cup and will likely make some noise.
I'm like, look, you know what? If you have the confidence to do it, if you're confident doing it, Lucas Cavallini scored 3 Panenkas this year. So this is not someone who's a stranger to it. I mean, I don't know how many penalties Lucas Cavallini is getting at the World Cup. So this is a different question. I think he's probably the only guy. I don't think I could ever see Jonathan David doing a Panenka. He's just too much like run up and smash it into the corner kind of guy. And I think a lot of Canada's penalty takers are that way. So to first answer your, the question there, I don't think you have to worry about seeing Panenkas at the World Cup. But at the same time, I mean, I don't mind it. Confidence is good. And it does kind of set a good message in a way that, yes, it's the 94th minute. It's a friendly against Japan. A win is on the line. You have a chance to get a huge confidence booster. And then a guy like Cavallini, who we have to remember is one of the longest tenured guys in the squad, steps up, takes it, and Panenka's it. Like, that has to send a good message maybe if to the younger guys to show that, again, you can go out and express yourself. You can play with a bit of fear. And I think the timing of it could work out as you're heading into a Belgium game to know that, okay, like, you're going to need, against a team like Belgium, you're going to have to take your chances. You're going to have to play with a bit of freedom, a bit of flair, a bit of, you know, grit in the final third. And I think Canada showed a lot of that. And Cavallini kind of sealing it that way will be maybe a good confidence booster on the other side. I think it's last thing with the Panenka. It's beautiful when you do it and ugly when you fail. And I think Cavallini made a bet, and in the end, it's paying off for him.
It might have been a bit of a veteran savvy move as well, because he knows that the likelihood of him scoring is fairly high. I mean, it's from the penalty spot. So however you approach it, it should be a very high chance of scoring. But if he smashes it into the corner and Canada just gets the win, first of all, that's a massive confidence boost. But if he panenkas it, well, then there's a bit of swagger that Canada has now going into that first game. It reverberates around the whole group. So while I don't like to see the gamble of the panenka, especially when it was so close to a stop, it definitely does give them a little bit of swagger, I would think, heading into a game against a Belgium team that is no doubt going to be the hardest game of their group. And moving on to David Anthony at @A_Miller16, Canada gets a PK to score their first ever World Cup goal. Who takes it?
Pretty sure we had this discussion a few weeks ago, Alex, but did we not say Alphonso Davies? I could have sworn we did. And frankly, I'd probably still stick with that, with maybe the secondary option being Jonathan David, but I still think I'd go with Davies in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, what's fascinating, and maybe I'll just quickly hop in and tie this into the next question, the question being from InterDave at Argentelia90, who asks, why did Cavallini take the penalty and not David? And then he adds, on top of that, if you get a chance to speak with the boys in Qatar, this is for Peter, please remind them to keep the Panenka penalties on the training ground. So that kind of ties into our last point. And I'm sure based on what we said, Peter might slip in a word. I'll see. I'll try to convince them otherwise. But to add that point, there was a good find there by Farhan Devji. Great follow on Twitter. He is obviously wrote the book on Alphonso Davies, and he noticed after the game there's a clip of Lucas Cavallini and Jonathan David talking and joking after, and many people wondering why didn't JD step up and take it. But he actually ended up giving the penalty to Cavallini when Cavallini requested it, because obviously Cavallini, a confident guy, he's always going to ask for the penalty. And Lucas Catalini, if you remember, in the Canada versus Suriname game, Jonathan David got a hat trick in a 4-0 win. And the third goal was from the penalty spot. Lucas Catalini had come off the bench and won the penalty. And obviously, Jonathan David, he let step up and take.
Yes.
And to answer, and he was, they were, David pointed out, be like, hey, that was for the hat trick. So they kind of paid each other back in that regard. But to answer that question, apparently John Herdman has said that it's actually up to the players on the field, like, mm-hmm. as part of the, you know, the brotherhood, the confidence that goes on, it's actually up to those who are on the field to decide. So to answer your question, I think it could be very well who's feeling it in the game. That's why I'm torn between Jonathan Davies and Alphonso Davies. I think ultimately, to answer the first question, I do think it's Alphonso Davies, just because he's confident, he's gonna step up, he's gonna take it. But just worth noting that due to the fact that it is decided among the players, I also wouldn't be surprised if David's feeling it. Maybe if he has a goal already, or if he's just been buzzing around goal, he might just step up. And, you know, if he's feeling it, I don't think Alphonso Davies is going to stop Jonathan David, because since he's a quieter guy, if he asks something, he'd probably say yes to it.
And Chris Talks Footy, at Chris Talks Footy, thoughts on Larea's twinkle toes that seem to invite an ill-advised challenge frequently?
He's a master at darting into the box and just wreaking havoc. He's done it for a few years. He's done it for Club and Country. And this is another example of this. His close control and just the way he drives into the box, especially while he's under pressure, it just draws those challenges, because he shows enough of the ball, but not quite enough to be able to win the challenge cleanly. And then he can just turn so quickly that it can leave you susceptible to giving up a penalty. And that's exactly what we saw. The most impressive part about that is it's on his offside, right? Because normally he likes to come down the right with his right foot. This time he kind of had to do the opposite in this case and still managed to win the penalty. And he had a very good stint off the bench defensively and offensively in the game, I thought, too. So that's encouraging, because if Richie Larea can come off the bench and provide you that energy on both sides of the pitch, then you have to love that if you're John Herdman.
Yeah, Richie Larea would make a good physicist. He understands space. He understands his body. I you just look at him for TFC. You've looked at him for Canada. He just does such a good job of running at guys. But there's almost this just calculated nature about it, where it's like, okay, I'm either going to go around you, or you're going to struggle to stop me. And I think that whole play on the penalty win was a great example of it. He gets his feet going, and then he knows how to put enough of his body that if you're a defender, you try to get it, and all of a sudden you're just left clattering through him. And it's an underrated skill, because it's one thing, you know, to go in the box. You see it all the time. Strike some forwards and players will always try to look for contact and they'll never get it. They jump at the wrong time, or they put their body in the wrong places. Richie Larea, his you know, understanding of his body is so good. And I think it's part of his game that's so nice, is when you say he ever gets in trouble playing out of the back, he does so well of just winning fouls and getting out of pressure and buying Canada time in those situations. So you do have to give credit to how Richie Larea is able to navigate himself in that regard. And you do know, no matter if he's starting, if he's coming off the bench, if he's playing higher up the field, if he's playing lower up the field, you know he's going to get himself out of some tricky situations with his hip movement and his quick skills.
Now, from Kevin Brown, at @kbrown_scout, is it telling that Ike Ugbo stayed on the bench as Cavallini came into the match?
I am in two minds with this, because I think Cavallini coming on suited that situation, because they were hitting some very good early crosses. We know Cavallini likes to feast on those. Not that Ugbo doesn't, but Cavallini especially fits into that. And he offers a bit of a physical presence up front. So I think that based on what the game presented, that was the right substitution. I don't know if that puts him ahead in the pecking order, because I imagine if Canada wants to get a goal late against any of those three teams, there might be opportunities in transition. And even if there aren't, I actually think Ike Ugbo can run between the lines and just find space in those compact areas better than Cavallini can. So I don't necessarily think that had any sort of say or sway in terms of who's ahead of the other. I just think it had to do with game state.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of torn, because I would have loved to see Ike Ugbo, especially as they go and chase a goal. But one thing you maybe can't deny with Lucas Cavallini is that he knows how to make himself effective effective when he comes off the bench, just because, you know, he's going to disrupt, you know, he's going to cause chaos. He's going to be physical, and he's going to, you know, really put those center backs under duress. And I think sometimes in a game where, you know, Canada had been relatively aggressive in their press, which was surprising because I think it was 32 degrees at kickoff. And yes, Kyle Laren, for example, put in a shift in how he was pressing. We know Jonathan David always runs. He's consistently a high kilometer guy. So maybe it just kind of made sense that they'd been running Japan center backs ragged all night in terms of the press, in terms of that. And then you kind of throw Lucas Cavallini into that. He's one, you know, he does seem press a little more than a guy like Ike Ugbo might. I think that was maybe just a bit more of a systems thing. But again, yeah, it really depends on the state of the game. Because I think, I mean, we've mentioned Ike Ugbo is probably the best. He is the best all-out number nine that Canada has, at least, you know, out-and-out number nine. So maybe in a game, you know, I don't know. I guess we'll see what happens against Belgium. Maybe if they're pressing less against a team like Belgium, it would make more sense to bring him in. If you're getting a more ball to feet with his back to goal, whereas, yeah, this game was really stretched. Cavallini made a lot of great runs to stretch out the field. He was very chaotic. He pressed high. It just seemed to make sense to bring him in this game. And I think that's something we're going to see with Herdman ultimately between those two. It just, they suit different game states. They're two different profiles. And in this game, the nature of the match seemed to, you know, call out for Lucas Cavallini.
And of course, Cavallini, not the only striker involved in this game. And from Canadian Footy Channel at Canadian Footy FC, what did you think about Laren's performance versus Cavallini's performance? Thoughts on Cavallini coming in over Ugbo? Not a huge Cavallini fan, but he made an impact today after a rather quiet performance from Kyle Laren.
Well, Laren, as Alex points out, defensively was very engaged, and that's encouraging because at the very least, you know, if you bring him on for 20, 25, 30 minutes in a game, that he'll at least work hard for you. But no doubt about it, the inconsistent minutes have hurt him because he's still taking heavy touches or sloppy touches. He's maybe a second or two late to react to certain situations. And in that regard, he did struggle. And I think he's going to struggle until he gets consistent playing time, because more than any other player I've seen, I feel like Laren really suffers with inconsistent playing time in terms of his technique. Some players will go weeks or months without playing, come right back in, and look like they haven't skipped a beat, Atiba Hutchinson being one. And maybe that has to do with his experience and just overall poise, but you can see the difference in technical ability between long layoffs over those two players. So that's a bit unfortunate from Laren's point of view, but Cavallini did look very sharp, and he looked good against Bahrain too, as I said off the top of the show. So I feel like that's also a good thing, because if you are John Herdman and you're only going with Jonathan David as your lone number nine, flanked by Davies and Buchanan and maybe Hoyland and behind, what have you, if you want to throw in some extra support, if you've got one or two guys firing, that really helps your case in terms of what you can do late in games.
I thought Laren did all right considering what he was given. I was very impressed with his defensive work rate. I thought he did well to get engaged off the ball. I just don't think the game state suited him, really. That was more the thing I'd say in terms of Laren, because he's also a guy that, you know, we talk maybe about some of his touches being inconsistent. He's also a guy that he needs touches. He's always at his best when he's getting 45, 50 touches in a game. He's getting his touches warmed up. He had 9 passes. He completed 6 of them in this game. That's not enough, you know, touches and not enough passes for a guy like Laren and for him to get into the sort of rhythm that we know he can get into. So I just think that also didn't help. And I think that's one thing that's going to hurt him against, in terms of getting a start against Belgium, is just, you know, these sorts of games, if you're Canada, you're going to need all hands on deck in terms of progressing the ball through the press and through these midfields. And it turns out when a guy like Kyle Laren's on the field, you know, you want him on the field just because you know that if you can get him the ball in the box, he will put it away. It's just, that's kind of irrelevant when you're maybe, by having him on the field, you're losing a bit in midfield or you're losing a bit in terms of ball progression. I think when Davies, Eustachio, you know, are healthy, it's going to end up being Davies, Eustachio, Buchanan, Hoylett. All those guys will just be there to progress the ball to David. And I think that kind of ends up cutting out Kyle Laren's role, unless he starts over Jonathan David, which we know isn't going to happen. I just think given these states of games and what you need on the field for Canada. It just wasn't right for him in that regard. So I think that's more of the issue that we've seen from this in the Uruguay game, is that, unless you can find him that specific role where he's getting a lot of touches, he's being very involved, his best role might be just off the bench as a striking option to give them a bit of a different look, maybe in the last 30 or last 40 of a game.
And from Kevin Brown, as well as Mark Pulich, at Mark Pulich and at KBrown_scout, I would like to get an accurate gauge of how we played. Was this Japan's B-side? How many were starters? Was this the same team that beat the U.S. and the U.S. really couldn't handle?
So in terms of their best 11, you could say that this was probably half. Some of those players did feature against the U.S. Some came off the bench and played fairly significant minutes, but Japan likes to rotate a little bit depending on how they line up tactically. So sometimes they like to go straight 4-3-3. Sometimes they like to go 4-2-3-1. We've seen them go to straight 4-4-2, which I believe they did against the U.S. at times. Suichi Gonda has started more over the 39-year-old veteran Kawashima in goal, who has been their longtime starter. So Gonda is their starting goalkeeper, but three defenders were missing, including Tomiyasu and Yoshida, their starting center backs. I think only Hiroki Sakai, their right back, was their only starting defender. From there, the majority of their players are regulars. They might rotate in and out depending on formation and opponent, but Gaku Shibasaki, Takumi Minamino, Takefusa Kubo, Takuma Asano, those guys are at the very least squad regulars and do get starts fairly regularly for Japan. So they were missing most of their defense and, let's say, up to two of their midfielders. So it was half of Japan's best 11 against likely 9 of the 11 Canadian starters we're going to see against Belgium as a barometer.
Yeah, Japan obviously also missing Daishi Kamada, who came off the bench. He's also a very dangerous threat of Eintracht Frankfurt. But yeah, I mean, in terms of Japan, it was about 5 or 6 of their 11. But also, one thing that is with Japan, as you could tell, they have a very defined style. And I think exactly. A lot of the guys that played in this game did well to follow the instructions. Like, Japan didn't look that disjointed to me. They kind of looked like Japan. They were pressing high. They had good patterns of play. So how I'd rate it is, yes, this isn't Japan's strongest team in the sense again, if this is a World Cup must-win game, maybe they have 4 to 6 different players. But I also think this is a Japan team that has a very set system. They've played together for a while. They do rotate their squad a fair bit. They do have a good chunk of guys who've gotten minutes over the past year. So I'd say maybe we can call it an A.5 or like an AB squad that Canada got to face, and certainly was a good test.
Yeah, half and half pretty much is what I would describe it as. But as you said, the fact that they really don't change stylistically means that you're essentially still facing a certain system or formation that's going to give you problems. And at times it did, and Canada adapted. So that's the important side of it.
From at LFC Youssef 5, does Hoylett get in your starting 11 against Belgium on opening day after his performance today? And Dan Clark with a very similar question. Vince Alvarado at Vince by Demand asking how you would use Hoylett in the 11 as well. Junior Hoylett impressed today against Japan. Your guys' thoughts on him and whether he gets into the 11? If he does, what's he going to do in the 11?
We've been saying he's going to be in the 11 for months. And I find it funny that everybody kind of just now realized, like, oh, he could actually get in the 11. I'm like, Alex and I are just like, yes, guys, we've been saying this for weeks. He's going to get in there. And even if you just look at past trends, Junior Hoylett has been trusted in big games. Look at that Gold Cup semifinal against Mexico. Look at the big game qualifiers they had against the US and Mexico and the performances he had in those games. He's so calm. He's so experienced on the big stage. We know he's played in the Premier League in some massive games in front of some very hostile environments. And every time he's gone out there for Canada, he has performed. And his ability to maneuver through tight spaces, the hips don't lie, Alex, and progress the ball through pressure constantly, even if the pass doesn't come off, the fact that he's trying and able to get through some tight spots and be able to even get the pass off is so impressive. That's going to be vital in games against Belgium and Croatia, especially, and probably against Morocco too, because they have a very fast team themselves. And based on how the pace of play might end up in all of those games, they're going to need guys like Hoilett to perform, and he did exactly that today.
Yeah, Hoilett's definitely, I think, at this rate, going to start against Belgium. And I just, what I love most about Junior Hoilett is how he's adapted his game. Like, he really has aged like a fine wine, obviously now well into his 30s. You know, before, maybe he was known more for that blistering pace, just running down the line and trying to cut inside and just, you know, whack shots towards goal and try to get crosses in the box. But now this is a player that you talk about experience, is someone who knows his gravitational pull on the field. Peter Tavisi talks about the hips. But it's just the tight spaces. I joke with a guy like him. He's one of those players that you'd send him into a phone booth with a defender strapped onto him. He would find a way to leave the phone booth with the ball still intact. He's just that comfortable navigating and turning. And it's huge because he maybe doesn't have that run of speed he used to, or at least he doesn't use it all the time. You know, his fitness and his legs get older and he plays a lot of minutes. But he's just so good at separating himself from defenders and creating the extra yard you need to get a cross in, or that extra yard you need to get a 40-yard switch, or he draws in enough of a player so that you open up space in the field. And I think that's key if you're Canada, because when they're going to have Alphonso Davies on the field, he's going to attract attention. I think Jonathan David is probably going to attract attention. Tejon Buchanan at this rate is going to attract attention. Stefan Oustakio is going to attract attention. When Junior Hoilett gets the ball, though, if you're going to leave him space, he will find a way to, you know, get open and do damage or find one of his teammates. But if not, if with his gravitational pull, if he can continue to attract defenders the way he does, all of a sudden that opens up space for a David, that opens up space for a Davies, that opens up space elsewhere. So I think just that way he interprets space in the final third, the way he roams around almost as a number 10, it's huge because it gives Canada another attacking body in midfield, and then it will also open up crucial space for some of their dangerous attackers to do their best work.
Well, and that's, I think, exactly how he's going to be used, right? Because if you look at the 11 today, 9 of the 11 are going to start against Belgium. I'm pretty confident in saying that. Alex, I think you're pretty confident in saying that. Ben, you as well. So then the question becomes, well, then who gets dropped to make room for Eustakio and Davies? Laren's going to get dropped, probably in place of Davies. Hoilett's going to stay in. And then you just drop Piet for Eustakio straight up. And that's exactly how it's going to look. And then you just have Hoilett playing in that exact same role he had from the start, where he just drifts across the front line, filling in the gaps, and just doing his thing and delivering excellent set pieces. So that's exactly how he should be used and how he probably will be used.
On the Rise at On the Rise FC, hot take. Hoilett looked unbelievable today, but that's also massively down to his set piece delivery, which made him look so good. Some of his in-game play wasn't as great compared to his set pieces. What do you guys think? I would think that they're two completely different parts of the game as well. Like, his set piece delivery was fantastic, but you can be a fantastic set piece taker and not be a very good soccer player. Not saying that Junior Hoilett's a bad soccer player. He's exceptional. I think he had a very good game today, but I do think that the two parts of the game are quite separated.
Well, but I also vehemently disagree that the reason he had a good game is because of his set piece delivery. That was certainly part of it, but he was magnificent in every other area. He was working hard off the ball, recovering possession in very dangerous areas, and playing in David or Laren to get a shot in, or Buchanan at times. He was feeding some sublime passes as well throughout the game. Like, everything that he was doing was excellent. And it goes back to what I said off the top when we started discussing Hoilett. This is what he does in big games, and that's why he's going to be so vital against the Belgians of the world.
Yeah, I thought he was excellent in game. There were a few moments where he managed to get himself out of tight spaces, like my jaw almost dropped. And it was, you know, it's just fascinating to see the link up between John Herdman and Junior Hoilett, because he was obviously talking a lot to Junior Hoilett. You could hear it on the broadcast, and then just how Hoilett would almost, just orchestrate. There's a few plays where Herdman would yell at Hoilett to take his time, and Hoilett's like, sure, say no more. And he'd just like, wait. He'd open up his hips one way, and he would be almost, he was like yelling at Jonathan David, like, come into this pocket I've created, like, find it. And then David would tuck in and he'd play this line breaking pass, and all of a sudden Canada would be, you know, past the line of pressure and be in a dangerous area. Like, he's just so good at orchestrating, is what I'd say, in open play. And obviously the set piece quality is fantastic, but I think he's almost underrated now in how he's grown. Again, old Junior Hoilett, I remember watching, he would just be run at guys, like cut inside, try to get shots. It was a little more like heavy metal than, you know, like a out and out winger, whereas now he drifts, but in like a good way. Like he just finds the space, and then when he's on the ball, he understands. I maybe talked about him knowing his own gravity before. He understands the gravity of the players around him. He knows that, okay, Jonathan David, tuck into this pocket and we can break a line, or Tejon Buchanan, make this run so you can stretch out the defense. And I just think he does so many of these subtle things. If you have a chance to watch Junior Hoilett, just watch him. Like, even if he's not on the ball, watch him. That's one thing I've noticed, especially if you ever get a chance to see him live in a stadium now, watch him off the ball and watch some of these little details he does to move guys around, to find space, to, you know, tweak his hips to create space, create lanes. Those are maybe the details that are hard to pick up, no doubt, but those are the little details that makes him such a difference maker in possession, even if it isn't always noticed.
And from David K at David_Keisman, would you agree that Kone, Hoilett, Hutchinson, and Osorio used these friendlies to boost their midfield stock, while Marc-Anthony Kay and Samuel Piet struggled and probably are looking at minimal time on the pitch at the World Cup?
Agreed on the first point in terms of the players who boosted their stocks. I thought Marc-Anthony Kay was much better today than in pretty much any of his previous games since the Charlotte TFC match, where he looked incredible in that game with the Italians debuting for the first time. He looked like he got his rhythm back. He was hitting those crossfield switches and just those killer through balls with precision and incisiveness. He was tracking back well defensively too. He was just overall engaged. I think part of that was just how end-to-end the game was and how fast both teams were playing, because that fits right into Kay's wheelhouse. So if the games are like that, I think he'll be more than useful for Canada, even in a substitute role. And he probably will come into those games as a substitute and be pretty effective at doing that. Piet certainly struggled. Defensively, he was pretty decent when everything was in front of him. But as I said, post-Uruguay, I think he's too slow for games like this, whether that's on the ball or just his overall foot speed, because there were times when he took sloppy touches, maybe took a little too long to make a pass, and at that level, you get punished. And if you're just not fast enough, you're going to get punished anyways. So in that regard, he struggled, but I still think he can play a role as like that maybe deeper lying number six player who can hit some outlet passes from time to time, because we know he is capable of doing that.
Yeah, I think as for Kone, enough said. He's just continues to grow into the game. Hoilett, we've already waxed enough poetic there with Tebow Hutchinson, ditto. Jonathan Osorio had, I thought, another solid cameo, yep. And he's certainly showing his feet. But Marc-Anthony Kay, first of all, he just looked like he was in the rhythm of the game. That was the one thing that maybe was the most jarring about Marc-Anthony Kay in the last few games, and you look at TFC, is that he was fighting rhythm. Like, Marc-Anthony Kay is a guy that when he's at his best, he's controlling rhythm. He's controlling the tempo. He's almost, you know, he's gliding along the pitch just because he knows what the speed of the game is at, and he isn't fighting it. And it feels like in the last few games, he's been fighting it. And I just love the way that he found the rhythm of the game and he settled into it. And I don't know if it was because he came off the bench. I don't know if it was the role he was in. But there was one move, for example, that you could almost tell Marc-Anthony Kay, you know, it was at his best, was when Milan Bojan played him this very tight pass up the middle, and Marc-Anthony Kay was surrounded by four guys, and he just like did a little hip shoulder feint and then walked through the pressure and then broke a line with the pass. Like, that's what Marc-Anthony Kay does when he's feeling the game. And I think this is good. We kind of talked about it in the last game, how he's been struggling lately and he needed a game like this. And I think this is huge. This is what we wanted from him in the Japan game. And I think that's good if you're Herdman, because, you know, you can trust him in that role in for Canada. As for Piet, I just think he was miscast in the wrong role. And I think that's why he was subbed off at half. It happens. I think Piet's shown that he can play a number eight role for Montreal, but it, you know, in certain regards, it also depends on the opponent. Samuel Piet is always at heart going to be, you know, more of a natural number six, but one who can progress the ball forward. I think he would have suited the role of Tebow Hutchinson played today, who was dropping between and around the center backs and progressing from deep. But with Hutchinson playing that role, that meant Piet had to play the eight role to kind of mimic what Eustáquio would have done. And that's a tall ask. Eustáquio's, you know, he's just so good at that sort of role, and he's going to need to be good in that role against these teams. Piet wasn't able to do it. Kone came in, and that's fair. So I think ultimately what this showed for Piet, and I think what the Uruguay game showed with Piet, you know, as he showed against Qatar, when he's playing a six, he's orchestrating from deeper. He can do a job, but maybe the number eight role internationally against some of these high-level teams isn't the role for him, and that's fine. I think You know, you got a guy like Ismael Kona, you got Jonathan Osorio. If Mark Anthony Kay is playing the way he did today, he could also play in that number eight role. If you need to, if you need guys to maybe, you know, supplement or replace Stefan Oustakio in games.
From Nick Spirit at Nick Spirit 4, should we not have given Cornelius a run? Given the speed at which these matches will be played, I can sense that Cornelius may be more reliable than Kamal Miller.
I can see where Nick is coming from, because I think Cornelius, in terms of his turn of pace and his overall foot speed, probably has the edge on Miller. But Kamal Miller, I still thought in possession was very good. I thought 1v1 he was decent. I mean, obviously in the air he still has his problems. I think we all knew this. It's all just about giving the players the right protection, right? Because we also saw it at times with Steven Vitoria that when he was exposed 1v1, he struggled and gave up a couple of pretty dubious fouls that in a competitive match would probably lead to one, possibly two bookings. So it all comes down to those transitional moments. If you can just do your best to protect your center back, and I don't think Sam Adekubi might be as liberal or Richie Lorea will be as liberal getting forward as often and staying forward as often at the World Cup. So I don't think it'll be much of an issue. But Cornelius, no doubt he can still play a role. I think he can come in and maybe give Miller a bit of a rest, because we see that he is still very capable in possession. We see that in the air he is a beast. Defensively, he has improved his positioning a lot. But Miller is still going to be the starter 100%. You can't mess with the chemistry. And as long as you have the defensive protection on counterattacks, won't be much of a problem.
And Miller plays such a huge role in the buildup out of the back. In this game, he had 76 of 81 passes. That's huge in terms of building the play out of the back. There were a few, I think there was one egregious turnover that did stand out. And of course, those are going to stand out in the, you know, in your minds. And maybe he could have got burned for it. But I think for the most part, he did a huge role there. And I think, you know, ultimately, when it comes down to these 1v1 duels, yeah, it's just going to, you know, hopefully a little more support maybe from Sam Adekugbe or Richie Lorea in those regards. Of course, it, you know, doesn't help in transition. It's a tough role. I thought Kamal Miller, yeah, I thought he was certainly okay. It was just a few hairy moments in possession. But considering how many touches, considering how important he is to the build-up play, there's a reason why he's been continued to start, and it's helped Canada play out the back. And I just think in terms of Canada, their play on the defense, it's always going to come down to transition moments. I mean, we're probably going to break down the goal in a second and see where the breakdown happened, because, Kamal Miller certainly maybe could have done better on the play. But I think a lot of also when Kamal Miller does well in games, he's also someone that if you can just, you know, make the game suit him and get as many 1v1s, you know, it's going to help him, versus where if those transition moments where he's on the turn, where he's running backwards, those are maybe areas like that we've seen in the past can burn him a bit.
From On the Rise FC at On the Rise FC, Miller was massively at fault for the goal by Japan. Caught ball watching and not tracking his runner. I don't think you can blame Borjan at all, who thought Miller probably had it. But what are you guys' opinion on the Japan goal? I think it was a mistake on both their parts, both Borjan and Miller. I think it was two people at fault, and then I think it was people falling apart in the midfield as well, because they had a little exchange in the midfield and they were left with a ton of space to be able to execute that pass over the top that confused both Miller and Borjan.
You can never, well, I shouldn't say never, but you rarely can pinpoint a goal conceded on just one player. Because an entire breakdown has to happen in order for a goal to be scored. That's ultimately what happens in most sports. Miller has his faults for sure. Should have read that aerial probably a lot better than he did. He kind of stopped halfway through and then started running again. He maybe could have caught up had he not stopped there for that split second. But Milan Borjan, I don't know what the hell he was doing. You could see that the defense certainly was dropping back. That was probably the first mistake, because then there was a massive gap between the midfield and the defense. But when your defense drops like that, the goalkeeper also drops. And then, hey, if a ball gets played over the top and you want to come out and cut down the angle, fine. But Borjan was in that weird no man's land where he was neither coming out nor on his line. So he basically afforded so much time for that ball to be shot and to be placed perfectly, because he was just standing there waiting for the play to really play out, essentially. So I don't know what's going on with Borjan in recent Canada games, because it seems like he's playing a lot more aggressively than he's comfortable doing. And I don't know if he's been instructed to do that because they're playing against more lethal opponents and opponents who tend to play a lot faster, and maybe the line is playing a little higher. But as Alex mentioned a couple weeks ago, Borjan's at his best when he is hugging his line and making those saves. When you ask him to come out, he's like a fish out of water.
That goal, there were a lot of breakdowns on that goal. I mean, it all starts really with the kick, because Milan Borjan got given a ball and he has to kick it out. And, it, you know, that part was broken down on the broadcast. His kick didn't go far enough, first of all, because he puts his boot through it. Canada then loses a second ball, which is the second breakdown. You, first of all, the ball is going short. Then you don't win a second ball. And then, you know, partly probably because Canada's midfield had pushed up in anticipation of the ball maybe going higher up the field in possession. So they don't win the second ball because they're high up the field. All of a sudden, Japan is running at Canada's backline unopposed. So those are the two breakdowns there. Third breakdown is that, yeah, Canada kind of goes in between two minds in terms of tracking back versus, you know, staying up and just offering resistance. So I'd say that's breakdown number three. And then breakdown number four, I think Milan Borjan there, it felt strange that he was standing at the 6-yard box or at the penalty spot there. It feels like if he was on his line, he would have reacted and comfortably made that save. And if he was, you know, sweeping, he would have came out and punched the ball. He would have been, you know, able to get to that 50-50, because a lofted ball like that, if you're on your six as a goalkeeper, you should be able to get out and aggressively get it off. So it just felt like he was in no man's land there. So those are the kind of the four breakdowns that I saw there. It was hard to pinpoint. It really all just started with not winning a second ball and the shallow goal kick. And then from there, it just kind of put guys under duress. So I think it's kind of leads to the point that, you know, Canada just has to, again, limit as many of these transition moments, try to limit as many times where, you know, when they're set, they let a team run at them when they're set and play over the top and catch them running and catch them turning, because those are the kind of goals that that can seem to kill them. And in this case, this one goal was a great example of those, all of those things culminating for one goal.
I also do want to point out that it doesn't excuse certain players. Like, I'm not excusing Kamal Miller for that mistake, but to pin it entirely on him is incorrect. And no doubt he has his problems dealing with aerial duels, and that's going to be a major issue at the World Cup, because I don't think there's any real way to counteract that other than, hey, just don't isolate him in those situations. And ironically, I was writing my piece for Sportsnet, and I was looking back at defensive aerial duels that Canadian defenders were dealing with. And ironically enough, remember Mexico's goal at the Azteca? Very similar lofted ball over Kamal Miller's head to Jorge Sanchez, who ran in behind, hit it first time, beautifully finished goal. No chance Maxime Crapoca to save that. But very similar breakdown in that they lose a second ball. There's tons of space between the defense and midfield. They have enough time to hit a lofted ball over the top, and then they score off of it. So it just goes back to everything that you definitely can't leave your defenders exposed like that if they have one particular weakness, because then all hell breaks loose, really. So I'm neither excusing Miller for the mistake, but I'm also not pinning it entirely on him, if that makes sense.
And another question from On the Rise at On the Rise FC. Victoria has to be the most underrated player throughout the Canadian fan base. Amazing aerial threat, great leader quality on the ball, and defensively, he's our best defender, as well as playing in one of the best leagues in the world. Who is the most underrated player among fans? Is it Victoria? I mean, Victoria now 4 goals with the Canadian men's national team, and I could even see him scoring Canada's first goal at the World Cup if it comes off a set piece.
Alex called it first. Listen, I still think the most underrated player, and we can't really say Junior Hoilett anymore because I think he's getting his props now, I'm still going to say it's Sam Adekubi. I feel like he does not get anywhere near the plaudits that he deserves. He is such a good, excellent two-way fullback. He attacks very well. He attacks incisively. He's super good on the dribble, technically gifted, defensively astute. He's also not bad in the air either. So that could actually be a, a way to sort of counteract Miller's weakness in that area. Is just have Sam Adekubi at the back post because he's actually quite proficient aerially with Hatispor. So I still think he doesn't get the credit he deserves from Canadian fans. It feels like he's one of those players who, when he has like a 7 out of 10 game, you don't really notice him until he gets really involved in the final 30 and like, oh, Sam Adekubi had a really good game. Well, he always does. It just might not have the same surface level impact that, say, a Tejon Buchanan would, or an Alphonso Davies would, or even a guy like Junior Hoyland would.
Yeah, in terms of, I mean, Steven Vitoria, he giveth and he taketh. We've kind of talked about it in the, you know, in past episodes. It's just when Steven Vitoria is at his best and he's got the game in front of him and he's defending deep, he's a tank in the air on both sides. You know, if you give him enough time and possession, he can pick out good enough passes. Obviously the leadership is a big one, organization, but also, as we've seen, sometimes if you get him running, if you get him turning, sometimes in possession as well, he can get a little just sloppy with it. But yeah, I mean, I thought Vitoria had a solid performance. I mean, any underrated conversation feels like it also, we talk out of Kugbe, I also think it has to, you have to throw in Alistair Johnston into this regard, because it just feels like those two fullbacks have kind of really changed the way Canada plays defensively. So if Peter's saying Sam Adekugbe is most underrated, I mean, I don't know. I feel like Alistair Johnston does get a lot of praise, so maybe he is certainly well-rated, but I also just think Alistair Johnston, he does so much. That's the thing, if we're talking about underrated. I feel like Alistair Johnston progresses the ball with the, you know, up the side of the pitch. He progresses it long. He can progress it short. He'll tackle. He can do one-on-one duels. He can play higher up the pitch. He can play deeper in the pitch. I'd also give him a shout for that discussion.
And a last question from On the Rise at On the Rise FC. Buchanan was phenomenal today down the right side, taking on defenders and linking up well with Johnston and the strikers. Do you guys see Canada attacking with Buchanan on the right side more often, as teams might double up tactically on Alphonso Davies?
Probably not often, but I think they'll still utilize the right side. Davies is still going to be the focal point, 1,000%. But seeing the way Buchanan and Johnston were combining was really refreshing to see, because we saw shades of that against Curaçao in June, but you put an asterisk beside it because it was Curaçao, and given all the debacles that were happening that week in Vancouver, I'm sure the players were still a little bit distracted from what happened. So you didn't really know what was real and what wasn't. But now we can say it was definitely real, because against a quality opponent, albeit against their backup left back and one of their backup midfielders in Japan, they looked excellent. Buchanan was a live wire on the ball, and sure, he didn't have that final ball or just that proper final action, but he was making things happen, and that's what you want to see. And plus, Johnston's vision is going to be such a weapon when you're going up against high lines, because he can hit a first-time ball out like it's nobody's business, and he's been doing that all season for Montreal, so that was refreshing to see for sure. Because on the off chance that Davies struggles or he's double-teamed and the left side can't really get going, at least then the right side is more than capable of providing a spark.
Yeah, I think that right side is so dangerous. Tejon Buchanan, just the growth he's seen in his game and how he'll be so willing to take on defenders and get it wide and get it in the, you know, into the final third. I think that's going to be key, you know, especially in terms of the ball progression. I think that's going to be key on that right side, because Sam Adekugbe does so much great work on the left side in terms of progressing the ball. I think if you can as well get, you know, Alistair Johnston and Tejon Buchanan involved on the right side, that's going to be huge. And, you know, Buchanan could have a big role to play, because if Junior Hoylett starts, I think he's going to end up playing a bit more of a free role. So Buchanan might have to push out a little more wide and have to progress the ball from there. And I think that's a role that he can certainly handle. So he's going to have, you know, a lot to do there. But as he's shown now against top caliber opposition, he can do it. And what's nice with Buchanan is that he's just a guy who seems to rise for the big games. He loves playing in big games. It seems to get the most out of him. So we're talking about a World Cup. This just feels like someone who's sitting there just foaming at the mouth, thinking about going out on the field and expressing himself on the big stage. And I think for Canada, that's huge that you've, you know, managed to get a player like this who just likes playing in such moments.
And taking a look at the women's national team as well, they lost a heartbreaker 2-1 to Brazil to close out the November window and close out 2022 as well. Vitória giveth, Vitória taketh. Stephen Vitória scoring for the men's national team. Anna Vitória scoring against the women's national team to take the 2-1 win for Brazil. Ashley Lawrence scored a penalty kick, earned a penalty kick just before the hour mark, but it wasn't enough as Canada falls in their final game of 2022. But overall, a fantastic year for Canada this year. They made a final in the CONCACAF W Championship. The loss ended a 5-match winning streak to close out 2022, 11 wins on the season. A lot of positives from the women's national team throughout this year, especially heading into a 2023 year, which will have a World Cup where Canada's goal is to win the thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a big 2023 for Canada. Obviously, the World Cup coming around, and this is going to be a big one. Obviously, you want to get Christine Sinclair a chance to win a World Cup in her career, because who knows how many years she has left at this rate. And, you know, it's just also, you know, you look at the team, Canada's getting a lot of players coming into their prime. Like, you have Ashley Lawrence, Kadisha Buchanan, Jesse Fleming, Janine Becky, all really in their primes. You can start to throw Adriana Leone in this mix of how good she's been in terms of finding the back of the net for Canada. So you look at their squad, Kaylin Sheridan as well, in that role. So Canada looking to go to this World Cup, really, you know, set the tone for future generations to come. And I think they've done well to set themselves up. It felt like at the beginning of the year, and even at the CONCACAF W Championships, you did wonder if they'd started to maybe stagnate. And you look at how much growth there was going on in Europe and in the, you know, the modern game, if Canada was a bit slow, a bit old in their veterans. And what I think they've shown again over the last 4 months in particular is that they can play a modern style now, that they can play a modern midfield, they can build out of the back for the most part. Still some, you know, holes to fix in terms of building out of the back. Maybe again a back three could be considered, or at least some tactical shifts that we'll talk about. But they're showing again that they can do that, that they can be dangerous on set pieces, which is a huge you know, aspect in the modern game, and that they can generate chances consistently. So a lot of things trending well for Canada heading into 2023, and I think this camp showed a lot of the good ones and also provided them with a lot of learning lessons. But I think every camp that they've had this year has done that, and what's been good is that they've taken those lessons at each camp. They've gone out and cleaned up and worked and improved at them the next camp out. So I think that's positive as they head into February, because the biggest thing of this year, which is worth noting, is that Canada struggled to get their full lineup healthy in 2022. If, you know, Christine Sinclair would be out, and that, but then she'd come back, and then Janine Becky would be out, and then Deanne Rose would be out, and Janine Becky would be back, and then Vanessa Gilles was out, and now Rose is out, and, you know, there's a bunch of players out. So I think what's going to be huge is in February, if all goes well, they should have most of their squad. Hopefully Nichelle Prince is among it, but it's really tough to know. We haven't heard an injury update on her after she left the game. Obviously Deanne Rose as well, also on a longer term recovery. It might be tight for her to get back in February, but to finally have most of Canada's players back, Vanessa Gilles should be back if all goes well, Janine Becky will be back, that's going to be huge, because Canada, it's, they've done so much tactical growth, and they've done it without having their best 11 for most of this, you know, year. And I think once they get that together, there's going to be even another step that they can hit as they try to track for the World Cup.
But the good news is too, they are building depth, and those players are getting meaningful minutes and are learning all these different tactical wrinkles, similar to what the men have done. So if there is a silver lining in all of that, at least you know you can rely on some of those players to step in come World Cup time and play a vital role should they ever need it. And then to think that they're still going to get some of their regular starters back in 2023, most of which will be ready in time for the World Cup, that just adds, you know, I guess the cherry on top of what is already a delicious cake.
A good season overall for the Canadian national team in women's soccer. They played 17 games, won 11 of them, lost 3 of them, drew 3 of them as well, scored 30 goals, only 9 found the back of Canada's net, a silver medal at the CONCACAF W Championships. And you speak about depth, 14 different goal scorers for Canada this season, Adriana Leone and Jesse Fleming leading the pack with 5 apiece. But when you look at this game, what did Canada learn tactically from this last game and sort of build on from their previous 2-1 win over Brazil?
Yeah, certainly Canada, we, you know, in the last game, despite the win, there were times where they struggled with Brazil's high press, and I thought they did a great job of countering that. I mean, they ended up inserting Quinn who came in the midfield, you know, and really provided a bit more of a natural out and out, you know, ball progressing, deep lying playmaker. Obviously, Julia Grosso and Jesse Fleming, an excellent pivot, but that's two box to box number eights. That's going to be more, you know, just getting the ball and progressing it through dribbles, whereas Quinn can do it with passing, can do it with dribbling, can do it from deep lying positions. And I think Canada just did a better job of bypassing that Brazil press, and it showed that statistically, funnily enough, in the first game, despite winning, they only had 1.42 XG, and most of it was off set pieces, whereas in this game they had 2.25 XG. They only scored one goal for it, and not, you know, some of it was off set pieces, but most of this was from open play. You know, and you have to remember that, yeah, Canada did concede, you know, early, but so there were some extent of them chasing the game. But even when it was 1-1, they really took over the game with their subs that Bev Priessen made, which gave them life. So I think the fact that they did well to play through the back, and they were getting more involved with getting their runners in transition, and they were finding the dangerous areas in the final third is huge, because in the first game they struggled. It was really offset pieces where they found the most joy. And they showed that, okay, that with some tweaks, they can, you know, progress the ball. They can break those lines in the press and then create for themselves in transition and in open play, which I think they can be dangerous. But as they've shown, it's been on and off. And I think heading into the World Cup, if they can be dangerous in transition, that'll be huge, because obviously they'll win more fouls, which is better for them with their set piece play improving a lot. And just you look at the speed and the threats they have on the ball, your Grossos, your Flemings, your, you know, your Roses, your Princes, your Beckys, your Leons, your, you know, Viennes and Hoitemas, they all love playing in transition and playing with in that way. And I think it'll help to get more of those moments if they continue to improve playing out the back as they did.
And one of the spaces with depth in the Canadian lineup is center back. Shalina Zdorsky showed exceptionally well throughout the two Brazil matches, but how does she fit in with Vanessa Gilles and Kadisha Buchanan also playing those roles? I've know some people have suggested Buchanan could play almost as a 6/8, but I don't know whether removing her from center back, where she's been so strong for the national team, for Chelsea, and throughout her career, is the right move for Canada moving forward.
Pretty sure Alex did suggest it recently that that could be an option, but I mean,
well, I suggested the tweener right back role to
yeah,
back well, so that they could play back three in possession, then back four.
Right, bit, but, exactly. Well, yeah. Speaking of back threes, though, like that's the first thing that comes to mind for me, and it makes the most logical sense. But Bev Priessen doesn't seem keen on doing that. At least, you know, having three out and out center backs and having like that straight up back three with attacking wing backs, and then just having whatever midfield you want and then whatever front line you want. But that would be the logical choice for me, but also not a bad thing to have some depth, especially because Gilles is working her way back from an injury. I know it's been a few weeks since she returned, but for the time being, the fact that you have three very, very solid top level center backs available to you is quite the luxury to have.
Yeah, Shalina Zdorsky has been excellent as of late. I mean, she's always been excellent with the ball at her feet, but she's continued to progress, especially defensively, and then she's always going to be a threat on set pieces. It is intriguing just because there's such different profiles there. Like with Vanessa Gilles, you've just got an aerial machine, one who's improved a lot with the ball at her feet, and she can, you know, be so lethal in 1v1s, and then Buchanan, just she does everything well. I don't think there's anything that she can't do defensively. You got three kind of different profiles. And I mean, either way for Bev Priessen, you're spoiled for choice, because either you've got, oh, if you know, you've got Kadisha Buchanan, Vanessa Gilles, or it was Shalina Zdorsky. The fact that, you know, you have two, you can only pick two of those three is a nice option. It's also not bad that your fourth option is Jade Rose in there. And then if you should go to a back three, I mean, it is nice to see. I mean, I would like to see it tried, just because it's like, why not? This is the plea. I may not have said it last episode, but, you know, play Janine Becky as a winger on that right side and have Kadisha Buchanan play in that right back, right center back role, where it's a back three in possession, so you can play out of the press a little better. And then off the ball, it's Buchanan playing right center back, but then she can also tuck in, have Becky play as a winger, off the ball wing back, back in possession, Ashley Lawrence just doing her thing on the left. Something worth trying, but either way, there's no bad problems when you have excellent center backs. I think any team around the world will tell you that.
And one of the players that wasn't completely involved in a lot of ways, but then came in and made quite the impact, was Quinn. And they were often playing a role in the Canadian team, The question is whether they should be starting for Canada moving forward.
It's a tough one because I just think, I mean, obviously Quinn hadn't played in a while due to a mix of knocks and injuries that had kind of limited them in the last camps. But every time they play, like in the last camp against the Morocco and Argentina, they just find a way. I mentioned playing as a six and can create from deep. It kind of feels like yes and no is the answer. I think for Quinn, it's really only in the right circumstances. Like I think ideally you're wanting to go with that Fleming Grosso pivot. But what, as we learned, if it's going to be a team that presses high and a team that tries to cut the supply, you need a player like Quinn in there, be it as the base of a trio with Fleming and Grosso or as in a pivot with one of the two, to progress the ball from deep and, you know, get them more involved. Whereas, you know, maybe in some games where you're playing a team that's going to sit a little deeper, maybe then Quinn might lose a little value just because they do their best work from deep. And then if you're playing a team that sits deep, Grosso and Fleming, they can do their thing in terms of breaking down the lines, picking the locks, breaking down in the final third. So I think Quinn has certainly proved that they should start in certain games and maybe, you know, against certain profiles of teams. And that's credit to how good they've been every time they've played for Canada in the midfield with the skills they got.
And how about Evelyne Vienne? She's really come into her own with the Canadian national team over the last little while. But how are you going to fit her in a very deep striker position for Canada?
Again, it goes back to the center back discussion in that it's good to have options. But I still think Evelyne Vienne is more than capable of starting. Like, you see the season she's having in Sweden and just the amount of chances she racks up. I feel like you have to find a way to get her in there. And I feel like her finally getting some consistency in terms of scoring for Canada has really helped her confidence and her standing in the national team. But then it also comes down to, well, how do you fit in Sinclair? How do you fit in Larissy? How do you fit in Lacasse and everybody else, right? And again, just because you have four or five capable players in those positions doesn't mean you have to start all of them, right? Because they can fit in different ways. And I think with VN though, she's the one striker who I feel, just with her goal-scoring prowess, not to mention the way that she can retain possession, get involved in the build-up, there's has to be a way to get her into the team more regularly than she has been.
I'd like to see Evelyne Vienne continue to develop a partnership with Christine Sinclair. I think that's the one thing that's maybe hurting her race for a starting spot, just because all of her best moments have almost been like when Sinclair's out, just because when Vienne leads the line on her own, she's so good at leading the line and just being an out-and-out number nine and then thriving with the midfielders getting her the ball and then playing off of that. One thing is that, you know, I've noticed is that Jordan Hoytema, her development in terms of becoming a hold-up playmaking striker is remarkable. I think she finished the year with 5 assists, which is one of the top on the team, if not the top. You know, which is incredible because Hoytema has always been someone who's just been known for being a fox in the box and just finishing chances and being more a pure number nine. And one thing is Hoytema links up very well with Sinclair now. They seem to combine well where Hoytema and Sinclair find same spaces. So that's one thing that I'm curious to see with Vienne. I think if she can develop a partnership with Christine Sinclair, she's just such a disruptor in the box that I think you want that sort of disruptive, you know, number nine wild card, just, you know, you're going to get her the ball and she's going to finish that she can bring to the table. But one thing that has been noticeable is that sometimes when Vienne starts, maybe Sinclair doesn't play her best, or, you know, Sinclair will play well. And they haven't necessarily had that chemistry where Vienne and Sinclair have both been excellent together. And, you know, that's something that Priestman's going to have to consider of trying to how do you get all of them involved? I mean, one thing that we did see is Hoytema got shifted out to the wing and she looked good there as a facilitator with, you know, Vienne leading the line. Certainly an option to consider as you try to fit all those pieces together. But again, not a bad problem to have, but there's so many layers to some of these partnerships. We see it with Quinn in midfield. They have certain skill sets in Vienne as well, where they suit some game styles, they suit certain partnerships. And the question is, how do you kind of tie that all together to get the best out of all these players?
And lastly, a few moves within MLS and for Canadian players. James Pantemis was among a couple of Canadians that had their options denied by CF Montreal. Certainly a bit of an interesting one there. Kerry Fayau also had his option denied from Montreal after impressing with Cavalry FC in the Canadian Premier League. And Kerry Fayau was picked up by the Vancouver Whitecaps in stage one of the re-entry draft after Montreal declined his option. He signed a contract at the beginning of 2022 through the end of the year with options for 2023 and 2024, and you would have to imagine the Whitecaps have picked up on one of those. Meanwhile, also in Vancouver, Lucas Cavallini's option was declined for the from the Whitecaps. He'll certainly find a new club, just maybe not in MLS with the pay that he was seeking. And over at Toronto FC, Jacob Schaffelberg, the pride of Nova Scotia, was officially transferred to Nashville for 250 plus 50K in general allocation money and signs through 2026 with an option for 2027. Quite a few moves for Canadian players across MLS. Your take on them?
The Cavallini one was a little surprising. Although then we find out that he is owed close to $3 million in salary, and you're like, okay, then I guess it makes sense why they didn't pick him up. So in the end, I guess it works out for both parties. Plus it allows the Whitecaps to probably sign a striker who maybe they see as a better ideal fit than Cavallini was, although he did have a pretty decent season. In fact, it was a career year for Cavallini in a lot of statistical categories, but I digress. The Karifa Yao pickup is huge. I can't explain how much I love this, how much Alex loved this. The flag at the Karifa Yao fan club was flying at half mast when he had his option declined by Montreal. It is back up and flying at full strength, baby, now that he is with the Whitecaps. And it works out perfectly for the player, and it works out perfectly for the club because they needed center backs, and they needed central center backs. Because now this allows them to sell Ranko Veselinovic, who I do think has his deficiencies, particularly his foot speed, and I do think his distribution can be quite inconsistent at times. Yao is a monster in the air. Very good defensively in terms of his positioning. And boy, can he hit a long ball. Short game might need a little bit of work, but in terms of his longer passes and his vision in that area, very, very solid. He might not start right away, but for sure he will be an option to start probably at some point in 2023. And that's excellent. Schaffelberg, no surprise. I think we all saw the writing on the wall when he got loaned out to Nashville, and he carved out a nice little niche role for himself there. So hopefully he takes some positive steps and keeps progressing the way he is. And Montreal might be looking for a new goalkeeper, which I'm not entirely shocked by, because when you look at the underlying numbers, Montreal's goalkeeping was disastrous. And Jonathan Sirois in CPL was a positive shot stopper when it came to goal saved above expected. So maybe he has a clear path towards the number one job there, at least for now.
And one question from Returo at that Returo guy. Hey to Returo, big U Sports guy as well. Play by play for the University of Victoria Vikes. Great pickup by Vancouver. And a question for Northern Football. Why did Montreal give up on Karifa Yao? His CPL play seemed to chart him as one to watch. What happened?
This one's, feels like a bit of a tough situation for Montreal. First of all, Vancouver, credit for them for capitalizing, because this is great market inefficiency that the Whitecaps have capitalized on. Because, again, there's a few things that stand out with Yao. One that just completely throws me off is on Peter's radar. Karifa Yao won 75% of his aerial duels last year. He won 3 in 4 of his aerial battles. Like, he was just a sponge in the air in terms of balls in the air in terms of defensively, but he's a tank on set pieces. He scored a few goals. He flicks on a lot of, chances for teammates to score. So he actually got a couple of assists over his time in CPL that way. His ability to pinpoint a diagonal is good. He's got decent enough foot speed. Just needs to, clean up his game in terms of playing out the back and just continue to adapt positionally as a player. He's still just 22, which is great for a center back, and obviously he's got the physical tools. But for this Montreal, I just think it might have been a case of a market inefficiency, because one thing is Karifa Yao obviously had the option for next year. You do wonder if maybe both parties were trying to renegotiate a contract just because he'd come in at the league minimum, and he goes into, they don't find a deal. He enters the re-entry draft, given that he has the right years of service. And what happens here is that by the Whitecaps claiming him in stage one, since Karifa Yao does have an option, they pick up his option naturally. That could be a market. That's a market inefficiency in the sense that Montreal, maybe they were, because no way. I mean, it doesn't appear that they wanted to get rid of Karifa Yao. I think, you know, they obviously loaned him out 2 years in a row. They've been very high on players they loan out to the CPL, and they want to give him a chance. But he obviously played in MLS back in 2019 and 2020. So I think that cleared him to be eligible for the reentry draft, and the Whitecaps pounce, which is smart. Now you get a cheap domestic Canadian who's going to be making league minimum because you get to pick up his option, and then now you can renegotiate him to get the deal he maybe wanted at Montreal. So it was overall just a bit of an unfortunate circumstance for CF Montreal and then the Whitecaps. As some know, some other people's pain is another person's joy. In this case, they got a very good center back at 22 years old, certainly has Canadian national team potential and upside, and it gives them depth at the position, but also someone who, if you tell me by the end of the year he's starting for the Whitecaps, I would not be surprised at all, because he has that sort of potential.
And that's all we've got for episode 96 of the Northern Football Podcast. Canada 2-1 victors over Japan. Canada fall 2-1 against Brazil. Please remember to leave a review and a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. For Alex, for Peter, I'm Ben. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll be back next time.